It's Diane. Great to be back with you for a Tuesday edition of On My Mind. On April 28, 1986, the biggest library fire in the history of the United States destroyed and damaged hundreds of thousands of books at the Los Angeles Public Library. Author Susan Orlean, living and working in New York at the time, didn't learn about the event until years later, but when she did, she knew it would become the topic of her next book. It's called simply The Library Book, and in it, Orlean explores not just the fire and the mystery behind how it occurred, but also her own attachment to libraries and why they occupy such an important space in our society. She joined me in our studio last week. Susan Orlean, it's great to see you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
This is such an unusual book. You thought you were sort of finished with writing books. You thought you'd rather continue with magazine articles for The New Yorker. Why did you decide to come back to a book?
This subject just captured me. And it captured me on so many different levels, as both exploring my memories of growing up, going to the library, my curiosity about why libraries are so emotional and meaningful to us, coupled with this discovery of the fire at the Los Angeles Public Library, I knew that it was simply too big of a story to fit into the scope of a magazine article. So even though I resisted doing another book, and I just didn't want to make that kind of huge commitment, I couldn't resist it. It felt like it was meant to be.
I love the fact that you have such warm, shared memories with your mother going to the library.
They are among the most poignant of all the memories I have of my mother. And we did this as a regular trip that we would do at least once a week.
Starting at what age?
I probably was about 4 or 5, and we would go to the library, and I would be allowed to run loose in the library. And that is one of the wonderful things. It's a place where kids can be given some independence, but it's completely safe, and they can't go very far. So it's somewhere where my mother would let me go off into the children's area, and she would go over into the adult section, and then we would reconnoiter at the checkout desk with our books to check out. It was just magical.
And librarians were kind and warm and happy that you were checking those books out.
And they just seemed wise and almost otherworldly. They seemed so special. And my mother would always remark to me, we just thought they were the most amazing people in the world. And whenever we would leave the library, my mother would always sigh and say if she could have done anything, any profession, she would have been a librarian. And I used to say to her, well, it's not too late. And
why
you have to go to.
Why didn't she become a librarian?
You know, that's a good question. I sometimes wonder, it's not as if someone told her she couldn't. I think it was something where she met my dad and got married and started having kids. And my mother worked. She, starting from the time I was about 5, she worked part-time in a bank. So it wasn't as if she didn't work. But I think she just didn't have the time to go to library school because it is a professional degree. Requires a certain amount of time, and library school can take a couple of years.
Because I'm much older than you, but in the time when I was a little girl and then even a teenager going to the libraries, librarians were much more strict.
Yes.
And not so smiling and not so friendly and very, very intent on making sure that you as a young person stayed quiet.
I think libraries have changed.
I do too.
Librarians probably, my analysis is it that for a very long time, librarians felt that their patrons were the books. That was what they needed to protect and care for and keep from harm. There was a change where I think they began feeling that their patrons were the people who came into the library. And while they were still very concerned about protecting the collection and keeping the library orderly and safe, their focus shifted to a kind of human service, and one that then was a little more flexible about what was permissible in a library.
Do you have any idea what year or years or decade that might have taken place?
I think in the 60s, when the idea that a library might be a good, safe place for teenagers to gather, libraries began, many of them never had had a teen section. So they began putting teen sections in and thought, we need to do events here. We need to make it an appealing place for kids to hang out. And that may have been one of the first big moves toward having the library see itself as a community center, as opposed to this is a storehouse of books. You come and you might interact with the books, but our number one concern is to take care of our books.
The fire that you spoke of in Los Angeles, extraordinary fire. Tell us what happened.
The morning of April 29th, 1986, just another ordinary morning in the life of the library. And the building had been built in the 20s. Beginning in the 1960s, it was very overcrowded. There was a lot of concern that it was in disrepair. And there were people who said, this is a fire trap. It didn't have any fire suppression. They didn't even have fire doors.
No sprinklers.
No. And actually, at that time, the American Library Association recommended against sprinklers because the worry was that water was worse for books than fire. The morning began just as usual. There are about 200 patrons in the building and about 200 staff people, and the fire alarm went off. Nobody considered it a very big deal because the fire alarm would go off all the time because
it was old.
Old building
with
a cranky fire system, and the alarm would go off so often that many people wouldn't even gather their stuff. They would just leave the building and figure I'll be back in 5 minutes. Many of the librarians just left their stuff in the building because
left
they
left their purses,
their handbags,
everything. Oh, my.
And coincidentally, the city had finally decided to go forward with an expansion of the building. And the architect who was working on the expansion was there that morning, as was a crew from the fire department discussing how to put sprinkler systems in. In the meantime, the fire alarm goes off and everybody evacuated, expecting it to be a false alarm. The fire department came, investigated, said there's nothing here, it's a false alarm, we'll just reset the system. But it wouldn't reset. So they decided to take another look around the building, and at that point they went into the stacks, the book storage, and saw a tiny bit of smoke.
A tiny little wisp.
Nothing to speak of, but enough that it would be triggering the system. they called out to the battalion that was outside to say, hey, by the way, we found some smoke, so let's see what's going on. And suddenly this erupted into flame.
Wow.
And it then burned for 7.5 hours.
Oh, my.
And rose to temperatures over 2,000 degrees. When it was all over, finally, 400,000 books were completely destroyed. 700,000 were damaged. And the building then was closed for almost 7 years.
Oh, my.
It was a devastating fire. And that was more than half of the entire collection of the library that was either destroyed or damaged.
Now, as someone who cares and cares about libraries as you do, it was a huge deal. But did you know about it?
That's the strange thing. I had never heard a whisper of this. I knew nothing about it.
Chernobyl.
Same day. And that was why the news of this fire, and this was it was the largest library fire in the history of the United States, the largest structural fire in the history of Los Angeles. But that same day, there is a nuclear meltdown in the then Soviet Union, and that's what was in the news, top to bottom. I was living in New York at the time. I'm 100% convinced that had it not been for Chernobyl, this fire would have gotten attention in the New York Times, in the front of the front section.
But you're saying it was not even in the New York Times that
day? It was in the next day, and it was on page A14, which is, you know, pretty far back
you
in
bet.
The front section. And I was a very avid reader of the New York Times, but I think being so distracted with Chernobyl, I never, if I saw the story, I have no memory of it. And I would never have known about it, except I had just moved to Los Angeles a few years ago and was being given a tour of the library. And the gentleman giving me the tour at one point pulled a book off a shelf, breathed it in very deeply, took a couple of big, heavy sniffs off the book, and then said, "You can still smell the smoke in some of them." And I thought he meant that they used to let people smoke in the library. I was very surprised, and I thought, well, maybe that's a California thing. They're very liberal about people smoking. He said, no, smoke from the fire, the big fire in 1986. And I said, what fire? What are you talking about? He said, oh, yeah, the fire. Well, I went home and immediately started researching to find out more of what this fire was that he was referring to, and I was amazed. To hear about an event, as somebody who loves books and libraries, and if I saw the word library in a headline, my eye would have gone to it. So to have never heard of this epic fire astonished me.
So then the question became, was the fire accidental or deliberately set? And this is where this young man, Harry Peake, comes into the story. Tell us about Harry. Quite a character.
Quite a character. And somebody who I suspect, if I had had a chance to meet him, would have probably found him both charming and maddening, which is really what almost everyone I interviewed said about him. Sweet, charming, lovable guy, and he would drive you absolutely crazy.
He could hold the job for less than a day.
He would be the kind of guy who would have a job working in a parking garage and park a car and then lose track of it, and it would take hours to find the car. He just would get in his own way all the time. He was a fabulist. He was somebody who dreamed that everything in his life would be a little bit bigger and more dramatic and grander than it really was. He fibbed about himself all the time.
Do you think he knew he was fibbing from what people have told you?
It's hard to say. I think that's a great question because that is at the root of this in a way. Did he believe it? Was he telling these stories because he actually believed it? Or did he know quite well that he was inventing them? And honestly, it's hard to say.
One story that persisted throughout his life and even beyond in his own family was his, quote, close relationship with the actor Burt Reynolds.
It took on the weight of legend in his family about how he was so close with Burt Reynolds, and Burt Reynolds once called Harry's mother to wish her a happy birthday as a favor to Harry. And it was something that his father and his sister said to me absolutely as if they believed it entirely. Is it possible? I suppose it's possible. I tried to reach Burt Reynolds. He was still alive when I was working on the book. He never returned the call. And I really just wanted to say, did you even know him? Because I'm not sure that Harry Peake ever even met him. I think that Harry's ability to spin a tale out of the finest fiber, maybe he was on a set at some point hoping to be hired as an extra and he saw Burt Reynolds or Burt Reynolds said hello to him. And that would be the kind of little shred of excitement that he would then spin into a great tale of friendship. And Burt Reynolds was mentoring him and he dreamed of being an actor, Harry. And so this was all part of this greater idea that he was on the very brink of becoming a movie star.
Always on the brink.
A perpetual brink. A brink that just continued being ever present and ever receding in his life.
How did Harry's name even become associated with the fire?
Unfortunately, as a person who had a compulsion for telling stories about himself that were big and grand and fabulous, Harry told many friends that he had started the fire. He first began by saying he was at the fire and had been rescued from the fire in a very dramatic fashion, which, by the way, nobody was rescued from the fire. Everybody evacuated.
Walked out. Yeah.
Very calmly. They didn't even run out. They walked out. But he told friends that a fireman had to carry him out through a window. Then the story changed a little, and Harry himself was the hero who carried a woman out of a window and saved her. Then the story took another turn, and this was the turn, unfortunately, that got him into trouble, which was saying to people that he had started the fire. After he repeated it a number of times, a friend who knew there was a reward, but also had heard Harry say that he had done this, contacted the arson squad and said, "My brother's roommate says he started the fire." Unfortunately, there was a young man who was seen in the library that morning in a few areas of the library where he wasn't supposed to be, the areas that were limited to staff, who fit in some general way the description of Harry. Tall young man with blonde hair. So those factors combined made him the prime suspect, coupled with the fact that he then presented 7 different alibis to explain where he was that day. After first telling investigators that he had started the fire, then recanting, saying, actually, he was nowhere near the fire. He was at his parents' house. Then he said he was downtown sightseeing. Then he said he was with friends. He had a range of alibis, which made each one seem less and less credible.
Harry wanted the attention, I guess.
Well, and what's strange is that most people want attention for things that are positive. And even if it's attention for saying you're friends with Burt Reynolds, you can understand how that would make you feel special or, you know, famous in some ways that you knew a celebrity. Those fibs are understandable. The idea that you would claim responsibility for a horribly destructive act that was to the tune of $22 million of damage, a felony for which you can get many, many years in prison, gave me the insight into his need for attention being undifferentiated. It didn't matter if it was good attention or bad attention. He wanted to be the center of attention. And it was a fatal flaw in the sense of his undoing and getting him wrapped up in this very unhappy, long, drawn-out legal issue with the city of Los Angeles.
How long did that take?
It was several years of back and forth where he was arrested. Then the city decided to charge him in civil court for the $22 million worth of damage. And of course, there remains the question, maybe he did it. Maybe he really did start the fire. The problem, too, is that arson is incredibly hard to investigate. It's the least successfully prosecuted of all felonies because the evidence is usually destroyed. And if you can start a huge fire with one match, so that match would be vaporized.
Gone, of course.
And it would be very easy to do that, really. I mean, it's a little alarming to realize how simple it would be in a library, in the stacks of a library where you've got the perfect conditions for a fire. It's not hard to start a fire.
Susan, one of the librarians you write about is Mary Foy. Talk about her.
This is one of the interesting aspects of the LA Library, and actually one thing that I found very interesting about learning about libraries. We think of librarianship as being a very female profession. In the beginning, it was not. It was a very male-dominated profession. Women were not, they may be the clerks in a library, but they weren't the librarians. And yet, the LA Public Library had as one of its very first heads of the library an 18-year-old girl named Mary Foy. She was so young that her father would walk her to work and walk her home from work because she was really too young to be out on the street. And yet she ran the library at a time when, by the way, women were not allowed to use the library. There was a ladies' reading room, and that was the entire access women had to the library.
What year are you talking about?
This was in the late 1890s. And the next five heads of the LA Library were also all women. So it was a very interesting thing that LA was very progressive in that sense, although the last of those women librarians, who was named Mary Jones, and she was a very well-regarded, very capable head of the library, the first one who had actually gone to library school, had served for 5 years in the job, very successfully brought a lot of good innovations to the library, and in 1905 came in for a meeting of the Board of Library Commissioners, and they said to her they would like her to resign because they were quite sure she would agree it would be better to have a man run the library. Mary Jones, to her credit, and this was again 1905, said, "I disagree. I do not feel that it would be better to have a man run the library, and I'm not resigning." And she refused to resign.
Good for her.
She was pretty tough. And the thousands of women rallied in the streets of Los Angeles protesting this move, which is quite amazing.
And sounds like the beginnings of the Women's March.
Well, it was certainly
truly
early on. Women didn't even have the vote yet. So this was a very impressive display of solidarity and determination. Susan B. Anthony came, and many leading suffragettes came to support this fight between Mary Jones and the man, Charles Lummis, who was being appointed to replace her. It wasn't until the mayor fired the library board and then called in the city attorney to resolve it, because this was a complete standoff. And Mary Jones wouldn't leave the job. She's my hero. She was really just said, "That's ridiculous. I'm not leaving." And she came into work every day. She told her staff, "Let's just get to work. Ignore this nonsense." But ultimately, she was removed.
They got her.
They got her. And she went on to be a leading librarian, took over the head of all the libraries at Bryn Mawr, a women's college, and certainly went on to great things. But it was a watershed moment, I think, in the history of L.A.
And in the history of libraries.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's looked at as really a significant moment. The feminization of librarianship came later in the century when there was a huge expansion of libraries in the U.S. and there was a real need for more librarians. So men finally begrudgingly allowed women to enter the profession, and they eventually really came to dominate it.
Susan, finally, I would really love to have you read a portion of your book where you actually burn a book, and tell us how hard it was for you to choose a book to burn.
It was incredibly hard. The reason I had decided to burn a book was I was writing a book about the burning of books, so there was just a basic curiosity. But more than that, it was clear to me that I, and I think everyone in society, has a feeling about the destruction or burning of books that's very profound and very deep. It's a taboo that goes back through history. It's seen as a violent act almost against humanity. Books are really almost an extension of us as humans. So to destroy one feels so wrong. I thought, I want to really experience this fully and see, is this really as hard as it seems like it would be?
So read for us now.
I decided to burn a book because I wanted to see and feel what Harry would have seen and felt that day if he had been at the library, if he had started the fire. Burning a book was incredibly hard for me to do. Actually, doing it was a breeze, but preparing to do it was challenging. The problem was that I have never been able to do harm to a book. Even books I don't want, or books that are so worn out and busted that they can't be read any longer, cling to me like thistles. I pile them up with the intention of throwing them away. And then every time when the time comes, I can't. I'm happy if I can give them away or donate them, but I can't throw a book in the trash no matter how hard I try. At the last minute, something glues my hands to my sides, and a sensation close to revulsion rises up in me. Many times I have stood over a trash can holding a book with a torn cover and a broken binding, and I have hovered there, dangling the book, and finally I've let the trash can lid snap shut, and I've walked away with the goddamn book, a battered, dog-eared, wounded soldier that has been spared to live another day. The only thing that comes close to this feeling is what I experience when I try to throw out a plant, even if it is the baldest, most aphid-ridden, crooked-stemmed plant in the world. The sensation of dropping a living thing into the trash is what makes me queasy. To have that same feeling about a book might seem strange, but this is why I have come to believe that books have souls. Why else would I be so reluctant to throw one away? It doesn't matter that I know I'm throwing away a bound, printed block of paper that is easily reproduced. It doesn't feel like that. A book feels like a thing alive in this moment, and also alive on a continuum, from the moment the thoughts about it first percolated in the writer's mind to the moment it sprang off the printing press. A lifeline that continues as someone sits with it and marvels over it, and it continues on time after time after time. Once words and thoughts are poured into them, books are no longer just paper and ink and glue. They take on a kind of human vitality. The poet Milton called this quality in books the potency of life. I wasn't sure I had it in me to be a killer.
What book did you choose?
I finally ended up with the only book that made sense to me to burn, and that was Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. Not only did it feel perfect because it's a book about the horror of burning books, but it also happened that Ray Bradbury had spent years and years in the Los Angeles Public Library. He couldn't afford to go to college. So instead, he spent almost every day for 13 years reading book after book in the LA Public Library. He then wrote Fahrenheit 451 in another library, the library at UCLA, where they had rental typewriters for 10 cents an hour. And that's where he wrote the book. It felt to me like the perfect book to burn when exploring this idea of why it's so powerful to destroy a book.
And how did you do it?
I took it outside. I took a big aluminum cookie sheet because I was very nervous. Now that I live in California, you don't mess around with fire.
With fire, right.
I took the book. I took a book of matches. I also brought a big bucket of water. I was really nervous about it. I struck the match, and the first match broke. I think I was so nervous that I hit it too hard. I struck the second match and held it up to the cover. And after a minute, the cover first was just smoldering, and then it exploded into flame. And within a minute, the entire book was gone. It was shocking. It was absolutely shocking. It made me also realize why this fire had the fury that it did, because books are perfect fuel for a fire.
And how did you feel after you burnt the book?
Well, it was a combination of being weirdly exhilarated only because it was so violent and so startling to see this book just explode in flame. And doing something so taboo, it was like painting graffiti on a city bus. I felt like I'd done something that was so wrong that I was kind of hyperventilating a little bit. It also was very somber and sobering to see how quickly a book could disappear. And symbolically, the idea that a book full of a story a tale that it could have been a book of history, it could have been a book of science, is just can be erased so quickly. And we're lucky that we have the ability to have books reproduced in great quantity, but it still feels like a little death to see a book disappear like that.
Susan Orlean, thank you so much. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on, and I'm so glad you enjoyed the book.
Thank you. That's all for now. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Natalie Uriv-Lipker. I'll be back with you on Friday. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.